Well, hello everybody. I'm excited to really initiate actually this Wisdom Heart Dialogue series with a conversation with somebody who I consider a friend, a colleague, and a teacher. It's Rick Hansen. And Rick is, I think, the preeminent articulator of this connection between neuroscience and meditation or spiritual practice. So we're in for a really rich conversation. I'll tell you a little bit about Rick. He's a neuropsychologist and, congratulations, a New York Times bestselling author, which is an awesome thing. I first learned about Rick with his book, Buddha's Brain, which is a beautiful explanation of the neuroscience connection to awakening, and his current book, which is the New York Times bestselling Hardwiring Happiness. In addition to being a meditation teacher, a psychologist, and author, Rick has done a lot to contribute to creating a better world. He's a founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, and he's on the board of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. Teaches around the world. And he has a wonderful, wonderful newsletter, and that is called Just One Thing, which I recommend that you get at rickhansen.net. So first of all, thank you, Rick, for being here. It's really fun. We've known each other, I'd say, casually and email-wise and through phone calls for a couple of years now. It's been really exciting to watch this movement of your teaching going out into the world. And I want to sort of start with this. It seems to be a burgeoning interest, or really almost a exploding interest in this connection between neuroscience and meditation and spiritual practice. And from your perspective, what is the connection?
That's a great question. Thank you for your very kind introduction, too, Eric. I think both of us, and as well as quite a few other people, have been riding a kind of wave in the culture. You could see the beginnings of the wave going back into the early research on EEG studies on TM, Transcendental Meditation, in the early 70s. And then really over the last 10 years, and especially the last five, that wave is really swelling and peaking. And I don't think we're done with it yet. I think, my own view is that there are a couple of reasons. I think on the one hand, a lot of individuals have both felt very stressed by modern events, the pace of change that everyone talks about, as well as a sense that somehow in most people's lives, the 99%, if you will, their own material well-being, is kind of stagnated, while meanwhile they feel more stressed and depleted and dependent upon. So I think there's been a movement to look increasingly internally to cultivate inner skills, to develop inner strengths of various kinds, which for me is really the essence of good old-fashioned self-reliance. How American an apple pie is that, right? As well as obviously how human is that in the broadest sense to cultivate things inside. So I think that's been one major influence that has led people to turn to mindfulness, for example, and other inner disciplines. The other thing that's happened is that there's finally a critical mass of information. I think back on the alchemists in the early Middle Ages who could do amazing things. They were really bright people and they developed all these various theories about why, when you pour two clear liquids together, they should turn bright red. But they had no idea, really, because they had no facts. They didn't have the basis. But now, with imaging technologies like fMRIs and so forth, we're now able to peer into the black box, the 3 pounds of tofu, the ultimate dark continent, right between our ears, and learn things about it. And now we've learned, for example, what's actually happening in the mind when people are frazzled or irritated or anxious or just, the usual. Or alternately, when they feel centered and clear and they can step back from their experience, they're observing the stream rather than being kept swept away by it. And also what happens in the brain when people cultivate these strengths over time, building new structures and changing neural function. So I think finally, now that there's that kind of information, people have started to realize, hey, we know enough now to really kind of go crazy with this stuff in a really, really good way. And also, I think last, Western science and Western culture has deep values of empiricism, what are the facts, as well as pragmatism. what works? You know, the great Dr. Phil Dharma question. So how's that working for you? You know, for better or worse, right? And the contemplative traditions, particularly the aspects of them that are inside the natural frame, that are not so much about transcendental or supernatural factors, which especially is the tradition I know best, Buddhism.
Yes.
Buddhism is also very empirical and pragmatic. It's not about taking anything on faith alone. So there's been a natural intersection, I think, of deep values in both the scientific tradition, if you will, and the contemplative tradition. And then last, I think the last thing that's really kind of helped serve this is that the research base for the benefits of meditation and mindfulness broadly is really quite astonishing now. I mean, there's so many studies of all the interventions, mental interventions in terms of neural impacts. I think meditation has probably been studied more than any other, as well as other kinds of studies for the benefits of meditation or related mindfulness practices for physical and mental health, both short-term and long-term. You know, if the great pharmaceutical companies, like Merck or Pfizer or what have you, if they could patent meditation in various forms, we would be seeing ads for meditation every night on television amidst the ads for Prozac and, you know, Viagra. I don't know about Viagra. I don't think we'd replace Viagra, but I think there'd be fewer ads for Prozac. Okay, hopefully that was not too long-winded answer.
That's helpful. And a couple things come up with that, particularly at the end, because one of the things that we hear from the readers and the members of the Wisdom Heart community is this: it is this sense that with this emerging data, with this emerging research, there's even more and more motivation for people to want to meditate. Okay, but many of them communicate that they still struggle. Okay, they still struggle with kind of establishing a practice for themselves. And I'd like to talk with you about what are we learning from neuroscience? What are we learning from the science side around sort of habit change or establishing behaviors that can help people who, in a funny way, even feel even more guilty now that they know how good it is them, but they struggle to set that pattern in their life.
Well, let's see. So first off, meditation itself, there are many kinds. Yeah. We'll talk about some of that, et cetera. But just the part about getting to it, I think there are a couple ways into that. And what the research basically shows is that motivation is fundamental, and it tends to be accomplished both top-down and bottom-up.
Okay.
And bottom-up is actually the most important, but motivation often begins top-down. So top-down, you give yourself an instruction. You know, there you are at some boring dinner with Aunt Sue, and she's telling the story for the fourth time about some trivial event. And internally, you talk yourself off the ledge. You say, now, Rick, don't be a jerk. This is your sweet Aunt Sue. You know, she took care of you when you're a kid. Shut up. Chill. That's motivating, right? Or it's comparably, you could say, come on, get up, meditate. It's good for you. You know, if Pfizer could patent it, they'd have ads for it, whatever. Okay, there's a place for that, and we guide ourselves to it. I mean, you know, writing intentions out, declaring ourselves to others, whatever works, and different things work for people top down. Okay, that's kind of the beginning. But where I think the real action is, and interesting in the trajectory, if you will, of Western philosophy and psychology, there's been a growing appreciation or a movement away from the tyranny of the word, the tyranny of top-down executive instructions, and the reducing of thought altogether to inner language, which is a tiny part, actually, of the ongoing streaming of consciousness, including reasoning processes, broadly defined. Anyway, there's been a growing appreciation of embodied experience, the felt sense of the body, emotion, sensation, and reward, and the power of reward. So in terms of bottom-up, to incline the mind, using that phrase from the Buddha, I think of the old metaphor of the donkey, the rider, and the carrot held before the donkey on a stick, if you will. The brain is the donkey. The rider is the inner being, broadly defined, you know, as process, not as entity, hopefully. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then the carrot is the reward. So if we associate reward again and again and again to that which we want to encourage in ourselves, we will be naturally increasingly inclined. And we will make that movement, that transition that's very well identified in psychology, especially the psychology of learning. The neuropsychology of learning is really kind of my sweet spot these days, especially. What we can do is move from deliberate to automatic. Yes. Top-down is kind of deliberate. Mm. It takes effort to exercise deliberate willpower. There's a lot of research on how you deplete willpower if there's too much top-down focus, whereas automatic becomes increasingly bottom-up. So if increasingly you help yourself imagine the rewards of meditating before you meditate to make it concrete, and you take in the good to really associate that experience of anticipated reward with meditation, you know, 10 or 20, 30 seconds, that's all. Do that a few times while meditating. Look for reward opportunities. Look for what is calming or soothing or centering or easing or self-awareness cultivating or other wholesome factors. Or think of it simply as training. Even if it's, you know, it's like a workout, you know, you can't lift any more weight today than you did a couple weeks ago, but it's, you still know that bit by bit, doing this work, you are changing things for the better. And tons of research shows, by the way, that if you do your meditative practices, you will be changing your brain for the better, bit by bit. And then after meditating, also look for those opportunities to really take in the good of those key rewards, continually associating them with, okay, I feel really good that I meditated, attaboy, attagirl, you know, I didn't suck today, whatever. You know, it was good, it felt good, yes, blah, blah. Okay, that I think can make a difference. And then last, make a moral commitment. My personal commitment is a minute or more a day. Nice. Usually it's more, yeah. But that's my commitment. And sometimes I realize just before bed, I haven't meditated, so I will sit for a minute or two or three. Sometimes petting my wife's head, you know, I call it meditation. It counts as long as it really is real, you know. Yeah. I don't think there is such a thing as watching TV-tation. I think that's a contradiction in terms, oxymoron. But, you know, just make that personal commitment and you'll enjoy the fruits.
Let's go back to that phrase. You've repeated it several times. I think it's a really critical one, which is the taking in the good, right? Yeah. Even yesterday, I was over the weekend, when people hear I teach meditation, invariably, I really want to do that. And often they say also, well, I can't do it because my mind is wandering. In a sense, they're paying attention to the failures that they're and they're coding it as I'm keeping not meditating, right?
Yeah.
But you're talking about something quite different, which is taking in the good before and noticing. This is an interesting piece. I'd like you to amplify during the practice time, whether it's a minute or 3 minutes. You talked about sort of capturing those moments of the good and taking them in. So what do you mean by taking in the good? This seems to be key here.
Yeah, well, to start with, you asked about the neurology, the neuroscience of motivation, and a key aspect of that. You know, top-down is more accomplished prefrontal cortex, often with language centers on the left side for most people. But the bottom-up part has these ancient little systems, early mammalian, you know, our rat-like ancestors, 200 million years ago, let's say, the beginnings of the mammals, who associated reward experiences in the subcortical limbic system regions to various stimuli associated punishment of various kinds, pain or threat, you know, of various kinds. So deep down in there, the brain is making these associations. And increasingly, the donkey is going in the direction of the anticipated carrot. Okay, that's part one. But to support that learning process, here's the problem. There's this negativity bias in the brain in which it's very good, very quick, and efficient at learning from bad experiences, but it's relatively slow and inefficient at learning from good experiences, even though the internalization of good experiences, the embodied registration of positive experiences, is the primary basis for growing the inner strengths we all want to develop, like resilience or mindfulness or determination or moral inclinations, loving kindness or happiness altogether.
Okay.
Right? So the question then becomes, how do we help this ancient brain learn? Right? We've got a 600 million year old museum It's stuck between our ears. That's how long the nervous system has been evolving. It's got all kinds of critters in there. I think of it as lizards, mice, and monkeys as the primary three classes of critters going to the brainstem, subcortex, and cortex. But anyway, how do we help it learn? And that's where the neuropsychology of learning teaches us that it's a two-stage process where first you have to activate a useful mental state. And then, unless you just want to waste it on your brain, if you don't want to waste it, if you want to keep it, if you want to turn it into structure, because that's the essence of learning, or shifts in function, then you got to install it. Then you have to help it sink in. And installing is not difficult, but you've got to do it a dozen, two dozen, three dozen seconds at a time. And lots of research shows that there are various factors that promote the installation phase of learning, primarily just stay with the experience rather than just moving on to the next thing. Stay with it so it can transfer out of short-term buffers into long-term storage. And then you can also turbocharge the installation process with one or more of other well-known factors like intensity. The more intensely you open to the experience, the more you learn from it. The multimodality, the more you feel it in your body, the more you act it out, the more you open to it emotionally, the more you learn from it. Novelty, the more it feels fresh and new, or personal relevance. And you can also sensitize your brain by really intending and even sensing that the experience is sinking into you. Sounds a little more, it sounds a little complicated perhaps, but it really boils down to four words: have it, enjoy it, especially enjoy it, because that's the installation phase. And the dirty little secret in mindfulness training, meditation teaching, and I'm all these things, I do it myself, I mess up myself, therapist, raising kids, executive coaching, human resources training, recovery, you name it, fill in the blank. We're good at activating positive states, but we've put very little attention on installing these positive states into neural structure. And therefore, most positive moments are wasted on the brain. If you take half a dozen or a dozen times a day, 10 or 20, 30 seconds at a time, less than 5 minutes a day, you can really help yourself learn from your experiences, which will steepen your learning curve as you go through life. In effect, you're learning how to learn by learning how to take in the good.
So it's what you're saying is that it's not necessarily a requirement to go away for 10 days, for example, and do 16 hours a day on a cushion, that a lot of benefit can come from these really quite short but intentional moments of focusing.
That's right. And having been on a number of meditation retreats and taught them, I'm a fan of them. And I think there's a place for intensive experience.
Yes.
But I guess I think of boiling it down, mo better. Two words, mo better. In other words, more episodes in which there's some kind of useful growth or learning accomplished through this two-stage process of activation, installation. And within individual episodes, more depth of engagement, more neural structure built per episode. Now on like a weekend workshop, say, or even a 10-day retreat, or you know, maybe you do it your own way. You go for an hour walk with the dog every morning, or you do a road trip every so often, just by yourself even, just for quiet, you know, reflection and so forth. Whatever your thing is, you know, intensive periods of practice, of course, give you mo better opportunities. They give you more opportunities for really powerful experiences. I mean, it's one thing to meditate for 1 minute or for 45 minutes even routinely in your living room, you know, once a day or wherever you do it. It's another thing, as you say, to go on a retreat where you're clocking probably about 12 hours a day of formal contemplative practice, sitting or walking and bringing it to bear as well with meals and things like that. That's going to impact you more. But most people can't do that very often. You're exactly right, Eric. And, you know, my personal experience is that if people make the commitment to, you know, 1 minute or more a day, you will feel different within a few days. One, from the meditation itself, but also from the bonus you get from getting on your own side to do it, making a moral commitment, feeling good about yourself, shifting. It'll shift kind of the way you think about the rest of your day, which will have nice benefits, and then it'll start creating positive cycles for you.
Creating positive cycles. So that's important. And that seems to be connected to this idea of building structures, I think.
Yeah.
So to say a little bit more about this idea of hardwiring, which is, I think, is what you're talking about with structures, hardwiring the happiness. and how that becomes, and you talked earlier about how that starts to become an automatic kind of self-generating kind of process, right?
That's right.
And this, so we're less than, what I'm hearing is that we become, it becomes less a sort of self-exhorting kind of process. Like, it's even in a funny way a less self-managing process and more a what? A discovery and more of a opening kind of process as the structures build? Does it almost guide us towards it? What's your sense of that?
It's a great question. And I think that if we, you know, in the spirit of where we started, you know, sort of the empiricism and pragmatism, what are the facts and what's helpful? Okay. What's true? What's useful? In that spirit, if you, as in contemplative practice or as in the upper reaches of human potential, it's true there, just like it's true in any domain, that if you want to get good at something, study people that are good at it. All right, just watching football playoffs recently, go the 49ers. Don't mean to. Hey, the Chargers. The Chargers are doing well recently as well. Anyway, you watch expert performers and you just observe that for them, it's moved to automaticity. It's automatic, right? There's a certain amount of top-down regulation, but there's a tremendous amount of bottom-up learned expertise, right? Well, in the same way, in our own lives, there is this cycle that moves from activation to installation to reactivation to reinstallation. In other words, from state to trait to state. In other words, positive traits, right? Resilience, moral commitments, loving kindness, self-compassion, mindfulness, concentration, positive emotions in general, optimism, and so forth. Positive traits are built from positive states primarily, right? The problem is the brain's not very efficient at converting positive states to positive traits. That's where half a dozen or a dozen times a day, you can really help yourself by deliberately taking in the good. And as you say, as you increasingly internalize these positive states and you build up these positive traits, you naturally move more and more in a positive direction. And I think what it feels like from the inside out is what people who are expert at various things, including expert at happiness, or expert at loving kindness, or expert at, you know, seeing the world is full of us, not so much us them. You know, they just report like there's this natural movement where I feel a little bit like leaning. You're leaning increasingly into the good, buoyed by the good, with a good wind at your back on a sweet downhill run.
That is wonderful to hear. That's beautiful. Let's flip it the other side, because I want to also talk with you about kind of how to respond and work with, we'll call it the negative, the difficult. And because it's certainly the case, in fact, the group was sitting yesterday here meditating and people were sharing about, they have memories of abuse or difficulty, you know, that they've carried with them for long periods of time, right? And then people, events, triggers arise in their life that activate those, reactivate those difficulties, right? How, so there's taking in the good, but what do we know in terms of neuroscience and this and the connection to meditation about how does this help us work with, we'll call it maybe the wounds or the challenges that are also, have been installed, you know, over decades?
There are many things about that, and you know, I'm a practicing therapist, and I've also raised with my, I've been married a long time and raised two young and girl kids. So, you know, there's a saying in medicine, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment,
exactly.
Right? So, I've had a lot of experience. But anyway. Well, a couple things here. So, first off, if we're going to deal with the bad, and I don't mean that in a moral sense, I mean it in a sense of that which causes suffering and harm, including inside ourselves. If we're going to deal with the bad, we need to grow the good. We need to grow resources that enable us to deal with difficulties. Inner strengths, broadly defined. Again, resilience, self-compassion, insight, the ability to disidentify from our experience, including negative states and feelings and thoughts and desires and so forth, and witness them and look at them. We need to be able to do that. So the question then becomes, how do we relate to the negative in the moment? And also, how do we grow the positive? How do we grow resources, strengths inside to deal with the negative, right? And for me there, I have a little model that I use that's been very helpful to me personally, and I've taught it to a lot of people. It's one where you think there are just three ways to engage the mind. I think there are three ways to practice. The first way, we simply be with what's there. We observe it. We don't try to change it. We might investigate it. We might open to it. We might sense down to what's younger and more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But we're not trying to change it deliberately, right? The second way to engage the mind is we make deliberate efforts to encourage things to let go of the negative, to release the negative, to decrease the negative, to prevent the negative. And then we also, in the third way to engage the mind, grow the positive, all right? We cultivate the good. All right. All three are important. I think the first one's the most important. It's foundational, but it's not the only way to engage the mind. And I think these days, frankly, this stance of just observing, just witnessing, has gotten way overrated in the contemplative practice traditions in the West, as well as certain non-dual teachings and certain aspects, mindfulness-based interventions in psychology, as if, you know, that's the entirety of practice. Even as big a fan of mindfulness as the Buddha, allocated most of the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path to various forms of deliberate effort with regard to the mind. Okay, so we do it all. So when something negative arises, I think there's often a natural sequence where first we be with it. We try to feel it fully as best we can. This is where resourcing ourselves comes in to be able to be with our pain. We need to grow strengths inside. So sometimes the first thing to do, honestly, is to grow resources inside so that when you finally pop open, you know, the trapdoor to your feelings, it's not like opening a trapdoor to hell. Right. You have internal allies. As they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Never go in alone. So you want to have resources inside. Okay. So you be with it. You feel it. At some point, I think of it as a Goldilocks point, the just right place. Mm. It feels authentic and appropriate to move on to the second way to engage the mind, letting go, reducing, releasing, and so forth. Honestly, sometimes that transition is 10 seconds. You know, you roll home, you're kind of stressed, you know the usual drill. It's been a long day, crazy traffic. You park, you notice you're stressed, you hang out with it for 10 seconds. All right, it's showtime. Time to pull it together, get the kids, walk in the front door. You know, other times, maybe you've had a serious loss. It's a year or two before it's time to move out of the first way of engaging the mind. But even the first way to engage the mind is a powerful way because you're disidentified from the content. You're observing it, you're being with it rather than identified with it and swept away by it. Okay. You're not hijacked by it. All right. Then you release, and then at some point, again, it'll feel right from the Goldilocks standpoint. You've released. Now it's time to replace that which you've released. And that's where there's often a natural opportunity to take in the good. So for me, when I talk about taking in the good, I'm really talking about neurogenerativity. In the broadest sense, I'm really talking about growing strengths inside. I'm not talking about positive thinking. I'm talking about realistic thinking. I'm seeing the whole mosaic with a brain that's biased toward the negative, if anything.
Yes, that's important. That was where I wanted to go next. So that's because I want to make sure people hear the difference here in growing the good and positive thinking. I think that's a really important thing to underline. You're not saying kind of overlay. Deny, you know, push away even. Because letting, there's a difference between pushing away and letting go. In the description that you're giving us here. And so I guess two things. First is underline that difference between taking in the good and cultivating the structure, these strengths. Distinguish that from positive thinking so that people can understand the difference here.
Yeah, classically, positive thinking means to really focus on the positive, if you will. Okay, and for me, I think what really is important is clear thinking. You know, realistic thinking.
Okay,
clear seeing of reality in its whole. And two things for me, at least, pop off the page when we see the whole picture clearly. With clarity. And so my point about that is that the two things that pop off are, number one, that the process of growing good things inside is this two-stage process in which you've got to go from an activated useful state to an installed useful trait. Number two, a clear-eyed view of reality tells us that the brain has a negativity bias. It is continually scanning for bad news. It isolates on that bad news when it finds it. Mm. It overreacts to it. And fourth, most relevant to my focus these days, is that the brain overlearns from the negative experience. It overgeneralizes from it. It fast-tracks it into emotional memory systems. Meanwhile, positive experiences, even though they're the basis for the inner strengths we want to develop in ourselves and others that we care for, those positive experiences are usually flowing through the brain, sheeting over it like water over a driveway, not sinking in. So for me, I want to see the whole mosaic. I want to have a clear view of the reality, both the inner reality and the outer reality. But that whole view tells me there are tons of good facts all around us that we usually don't even notice. Or second, if we notice them, we don't feel anything. Someone pays us a compliment, oh, nice, whatever. Or we get something done, I finished that email, or, I got through that difficult thing without a bad event, whatever. We don't feel anything. The good we notice a good fact, but it doesn't move the needle. It doesn't become a good experience. Or third, even if we notice a good fact and it becomes a good experience, we usually don't take it in. We usually don't help our brain. We usually, fought and the flow of experience is quick. But the processes of memory making, of structure building, including the inner strengths broadly defined I'm talking about, that's a slower process. We got to help that little mouse inside us, that little lizard inside us, learn from these positive experiences. So then we become, as we said earlier, increasingly automatically inclined in a positive direction. Otherwise, those useful mental states just wash through us with no lasting value.
I'd like to move toward the end of our conversation with an experience, building on what we've done, if you're comfortable with that. Sure. Could you guide us through a 1 to 3 minute
a
practice so we get a sense of, actually how to, we start to build that structure ourselves as we're...
And if people are interested in this, I mean, my book, Hardwiring Happiness, is kind of like the textbook on taking the good, although it's a lot more readable than most textbooks. It's accessible.
I want to say, I want to underline that. That's really important for the people, for the listeners, is that Rick takes the science. I have read a lot of books before I got to Buddha's Brain, and that was the one that helped me really understand, and then the new work, I consider it sort of the application manual. Yeah. The Buddha's Brain sort of set the frameworks up. There were some practices in there, but the new work really is a, it's an application manual for how to take the information and begin to internalize it, which I think is so powerful, and it's so clearly done. I want to stress that for folks.
Thank you very much. And also, freely, there are a lot of examples of or ways in which people can access my material, freely on my website and YouTube and whatnot. Okay, all that said, if you think about it, as every day our experiences are continually changing our brain. That's what scientists call experience-dependent neuroplasticity, plasticity being the capacity of something to change. The real question is, who's doing that changing? Are we in charge of those change processes, those learning processes, with the brain that's biased toward negative learning, right? Or are other forces in charge of that? So what that book's about, Hardwiring Happiness, is the fundamental process of getting good at changing your own brain for the better using enjoyable experiences as the primary way to do that. So that's pretty cool, I think. But anyway, to go through it here, okay, you want to do a little practice?
Yeah,
so
let's do one.
I'll do it in I'll do it two times. In the first way we'll do it, we'll just notice a positive experience that's already present and help it sink in. So in this moment, anybody who's listening to this or watching it, call to be aware of the fact that in the background of awareness is the ongoing experience that you're actually basically all right now. In other words, in a kind of animal survival sense, you're actually just fine. Your body is continually telling your brain how it's doing, and most minutes for most people of most days, your body's doing okay. It's not a perfect moment, but it's basically all right. So I'll be quiet for a moment. As you locate the sense of enough air to breathe, your body's okay, It's already there in the background of awareness. Move it to the foreground as I be quiet here, and just recognize and be with the sense that you're actually fundamentally all right right now. And once you have a sense of feeling all right, which may need to be renewed from time to time, take in the good, help this experience get installed now that it's activated by simply resting in it, protecting it, creating sanctuary for this experience in your mind, feeling it in your body, and getting a sense that this experience of feeling all right right now is really sinking into you. You're marinating in it. Okay, so that was the first cycle through that. And I took a little time. When you do it normally on your own, it's 10, 20, 30 seconds at a time. It's the embodied registration of an experience. So in a way, it's, and with related attitudes of being a friend to yourself and a kind of sweetness, a kind of kindness, and also a sense of opening to the experience, really receiving it without clinging to it. That is a very important point for many people, especially. You're actually receiving these positive experiences to gradually undo clinging and craving. Because as you build up the felt sense inside yourself of your core needs met, there's less and less underlying sense of deficit or disturbance, which is the basis of craving, clinging, and suffering and harm. Okay. Let's try it again one last time, kind of quickly. This time we'll create a positive experience in the first place. We'll activate or have a positive experience at will. In this case, think of one or more things you feel grateful for or glad about. And then once you access a sense of gratitude, which could be fairly subtle, see if you can install it by enriching this experience of gratitude. In other words, by staying with it and giving your mind over to it, maybe exploring what it feels like in your body to be grateful, and also intending and sensing that this experience is sinking into you. Again, I'll be quiet here as you really soak in this experience of gratitude. It's okay to be aware of more than one thing you feel glad about or grateful for. Again, you're just kind of marinating in a sense of gladness or gratitude. Okay, that was it.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Not too bad. And it's nice to realize that you can do this many times a day on the fly. And as a very important detail, you can look for those key experiences that will really help you with what you're dealing with these days. I've developed this model based on the models of other people that basically we have three fundamental needs: safety, satisfaction, and connection. And if you have issues in one of those fundamental needs that every animal has, including a sophisticated animal like us, if you have needs in any one of those areas, you need resources, resource experiences that address those particular needs, that are targeted at them. So for example, if you feel anxious or angry or trapped and immobilized, that's a safety system issue. It would help you to have experiences of feeling protected or relaxed, or notice that you're all right now, or strong. That'll help you deal with that. Or if you have issues in terms of the satisfaction system. Maybe you feel disappointed, you've had a loss, you're frustrated, you're thwarted. There it would help you to have experiences of reward experiences of gladness or gratitude or accomplishment or pleasure, wholesome pleasures of various kinds, the fullness of the moment. Or if you have issues in the connection system, maybe you feel hurt or rejected or lonely or dealing with childhood issues like that of abandonment or shame. There are experiences, resource experiences in which you feel connected to others would really help. Experiences like feeling cared about, feeling seen, feeling liked, appreciated, included, or even loved. And so if you know what your particular, I call it the vitamin C is, what's your vitamin C, you can look for opportunities to really have that experience. And then if you want, you can use the fourth step of taking the good, the optional one, where you link and you're aware of both that positive material simultaneous with some negative material in the kind of the margins of the mind, the wings, if you will, on the stage of awareness. And the since neurons that fire together wire together, by holding both of those in awareness at the same time, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, the positive will associate with the negative, gradually soothing and easing it, eventually even potentially replacing it. Okay, great.
That is a critical piece. And it's something that if people want to learn more about that, which is I hope they do, because this is clearly a key. We all are carrying various deficits. And I love this idea of sort of diagnosing and then prescribing in a very specific way, you know, that we'll call them those strengths or those inner resource vitamins that are going to rebalance the system. And I think the invitation here that Rick is making to us is that we can become proactive. We can become creative. We can even become sort of artistic designers of our experience in a way that allows us to actually open more fully to the reality of life and to become more engaged in a way that nourishes ourselves and also nourishes those that are in our world. So I really want to thank you for both the experience and also the teaching, and most of all for really being a presence in the world that's helping people to grow and to open up.
Thank you, Eric. You're so articulate yourself and good-hearted, and I think of you also as a force. So may all the people who see this and listen to this, you know, may be helpful to you.
Good. And people, remember, rickhansen.net. You can find so many wonderful resources there. Okay. That's great. All for today. Thank you so much.